With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we travel back to Italy, to the Gladio network, the Stay Behind network, and Ola will give us an introduction into why this is important for Sweden too.
Right. I'm trying to draw historical parallels. Events in Italy is similar to what happened in the 60s and 70s, is similar to what happened in Swedish in the 80s. And it was false flag operations, psychological operations, trying to bend the minds of the Italian people, the Italian media, the Italian politicians, to be in line with American interests. And the biggest threat to the American interests, the Sixth Fleet Naval Base and the military presence and the foothold in Italy, was the former Prime Minister Aldo Moro, who was murdered by Stay Behind in Italy, controlled by the Americans, and with cooperation with some people in Italy and in high level.
I would like to interrupt, because officially, if you look it up, it is Aldo Moro was killed by the Red Brigades. You have to explain, I think, why Red Brigades and Stay Behinds in this version is the same.
Well, it's all circumstantial evidence. Of course, there are lots of secrecy, and what's in Wikipedia, wherever you read.
Sorry, I have to laugh.
It's not the real truth, but it's also, you have to make up your own mind. Everybody has to make up your own minds to what you believe is true. It's circumstantial evidence, and people in important places have said that the Americans killed Aldo Moro. People in important places have said that Red Brigade's leadership was infiltrated by Gladio, Stay Behind, from 1974 and onwards. So When they say that Red Brigade's killed Aldo Moro, it was Red Brigade's under the rule of Italian Gladio's Italian Stay Behind. That is, it was the American standing troops, so to say, secret standing troops in Italy that killed Aldo Moro. And that is what also is said by people working for the State Department in United States, being in Italy at the time, has written books about. So, and I also want to make a little prehistory, because we have this document from 1962 that the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Cuba crisis wanted to instigate false flag activities on American soil and with American citizens being killed by American hands, but blamed on Cuban agents and Cuban people to stir emotions in American public, in media and so on, exactly the same as in Italy. And it this I think it was called the Northwood paper or something. It was,
Operation Northwoods, yeah.
Yeah, it was General Lemnitzer, who later headed the NATO in Europe, who was head of the Chief of Staff, and he wanted this, and also General Major, later General Major Edward Lansdale, who wanted this. And it was stopped by no other than John F. Kennedy shortly before he was murdered himself. But
All the Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed with that. So that, I think, is important. It was all the military
They were going to hijack American planes. They were going to kill the crew and the passengers. And they were going to blame it on the Cuban agents, Fidel Castro's agents. And there were a lot of other false flag activities planned also. Kennedy stopped it all. But it's the same thinking they used in Strategy of Tension in Italy some years later. I think it started 68 or something like that, with a bombing in Bologna, where I think 85 people were killed. Or I don't remember the tally of it, but people were murdered, killed, and wounded at Bologna train station. And it was the gladiators that were behind this, fascists. And it was blamed on the left. And so you have that, you have the same thinking established in Joint Chiefs of Staff around 62, the Cuban crisis, used in Italy in the 60s, 70s. And also some people connecting. We have the CIA director Alan Dulles heading all this, and the station chief for special operations CIA, who was former the station chief in Italy, Harvey, was then later heading the special operations in CIA, and this was revealed in 1976. I think was the Select Committee of Assassins, I think it was called. The Senate had hearings, and they were talking about they tried to kill Fidel Castro, and they killed the military head of the military, the Chilean military under Allende. General Schneider.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm saying is that the same thinking established in America, Joint Chiefs of Staff, prohibited, stopped by John F. Kennedy, was used in Italy in the 70s and was used in Sweden in the 80s. Because also in Sweden, we had these false flags. It was psychological operations in aiming at bending the Swedish minds to be in line with American interests, that is to see Soviet as a big threat and not try to come up with any dialogue or something that could disturb now that Soviet soon would be, you know, something else. And the American influence, of course, should be there and not the Swedish. Swedes only, today were 11 million people, at that time around 7 million people, nine perhaps, but anyhow, a small nation. And but anyhow, as you described, Dirk, Olof Palme had a bigger role than his nation. And when I look on this, it's very clear for me that I have to look on it as a psychological operations, and that there's a connection.
I might remind you about the Gene Tatum. You were talking to this person, a very interesting person, an operative of the intelligence service of the United States. But maybe you tell that story. You were.
Well, I have been in contact with him and in dialogue with him and over the years, and he was put in jail when he left an organization headed by Vice President at the time, George H.W. Bush, former CIA director and so on, long time CRA operative, and he stopped doing work for that organization when he was told to. He had to stop in some way Ross Perot, who was a competitor to Bush in the primaries in the Republican Party in before the elections. Was it 88?
Yeah, he was an independent candidate. He was not a Republican. He was not a Democrat.
Right,
Ross
right.
Perot.
He was independent. But he was taking votes from Bush if he succeeded. And Tatum explained to me that he would not do activities neutralizing politicians on American soil and if they're American citizens.
Yeah, so, and again, I have to interrupt, because what Tatum did, he was killing people for the American side, and not 10, not 50, but something in the three-digit range, in the lower three-digit range. But he was simply killing off people for the American state. And when he was ordered to do the same or to harm Americans inside America, that was his red line that he didn't want to step over.
Right. And he was heading, you know, in the Iran-Contra affair starting in 1980. Some say it started later, but it started really with the October surprise in 1980, the fall of 1980, when the American hostages were kept until Reagan had his inauguration speech at the Capitol in January 1981. And then they were all released. Carter, he would have liked to have them released earlier, but the people around Reagan managed to stop that, and Gene Tatum was working for these people already at that time. Later, he became head of the part of Iran-Contra that dealt with things, as you said, you know, neutralizations of people. After him, there was General Singlaub, who was also heading the World Anti-Communist League. He was heading the same group within this organization headed by Oliver North. And it was dealing with arms to Iran, the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. They were given weapons from America, you know, it sounds strange. And they were paying a lot of money, of course, for this. And the money was used to support the Contra rebels that was they were fighting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And I actually in August 81 I went to Nicaragua to talk to Juventud Sandinista, and I was taken out in the jungle close to the Honduran border, and the night before a bridge had been blown up, and there were people there, volunteers, youth, working to restore the bridge. And I talked to them, and on the way back, I asked why my companion, a Juventud Sandinista official, why he had a briefcase with him all the time in the jungle. And was it important papers or was it? No, he opened it and it was a big revolver. You know, when you're young, you're kind of naive. I was kind of naive and didn't think much. And then this was a risky thing, of course. But the weapons, that the dynamite and so on that blew up that bridge, it was provided by the CIA to and this Iran-Contra organization within, or partly outside CIA, headed by Oliver North. And they got the money from the arms sales to the Iran Revolutionary Guard that made a revolution in 79 and took power from the Shah. The American put a dictator in Iran from 53. And then, of course, there was some drugs, cocaine, smuggled from the rebel bases in Honduras to the United States and into the American public domain to be used in Los Angeles and other places. And this has been revealed by Gary Webb, the journalist that supposedly killed himself, and by
with two shots in the back of his head. He killed himself by shooting two times
in the head.
And I want to wrap it up again, because Iran-Contra is very complicated, really. Yeah. So it was in the United States, the Reagan government wanted to have a worldwide fight against leftists, what they considered that. And that was, for example, in Europe, the Social Democrats, like in Germany or in Britain or in Sweden, but also against in Africa, the movements there that were supported by Sweden, and Nicaragua was a mainstay. So, but the in the parliament, they were not able to get the money. So they made a deal. They were providing weapons to the Iranians, their arch enemies, and they got money. With a steal, they get money from the Iranians on a black money, which was not official somewhere. It was run by the intelligence agencies. And it went, they used it to support the anti-Sandinistas, the anti-revolutionaries in Nicaragua. So fighting against the leftist government there. And also to pay for that, they produced cocaine in the jungle in Honduras, which they shipped back with the planes that delivered the weapons to the Nicaraguan and the money to for the Nicaraguan soldiers. There were small planes delivering money. On the way back, they shipped the cocaine into the United States, where it was sold, for example, in Los Angeles. And the head of the CIA once said it was what the American drug addicts could do for the struggle for freedom in Middle America. It was their part of the operation, so to speak, to smoke crack for the American liberty. These are my words now, the last ones. But he said it was their contribution to the effort. So this is the weird scheme that was published, as you said, by Gary Webb, who first was praised for his good journalism, and then he was brought down to his knees. He didn't get any jobs anymore, could not work, marriage done in dire situation with a lot of debts. And then in the end, allegedly, he was found with two shots in the back of his head, and it was officially considered a suicide, these two shots.
Yes. And why are we talking about Iran-Contra and Gene Tatum? Well, it's because there's another lead to the Olof Palme murder. And Sweden has always had, due to its non-alignment and an own defense industry, we've produced military airplanes and howitzers. We have had a strong weapons industry, and we still have, because of our non-alignment, we have to support ourselves with weaponry. And of course, the market is kind of small for those companies and the owners of those companies, so they try to get markets elsewhere. And there was a distribution system established in the early 1980s. Actually, I have a journalist that said to me that who really knows those things, worked as a correspondent in the Middle East for a Swedish business paper. And he said that there was a cable from a Swedish diplomatic cable already in early 1980 about this weaponry, Swedish weaponry. So there was a distribution line established between Sweden and Iran, and there were a lot of powder and pentyl dynamite, so to say, and other things. Also a missile called Robot 70. This has been questioned, the last thing, but it's quite sure. The Die Welt wrote in February 1986, February 12th, that Sweden was sending missiles to Iran. Mm. And Die Welt is a very conservative paper.
We have to have another break, Ulla, so we get back to the story this strange case of Iran-Contra is deeply connected to the Palme murder after the advertisement.
Patrick Henningsen on TNT Radio.
The recent attacks, especially on the Kerch Strait Bridge, which connects mainland Russia to Crimea, they think it's a truck bomb. Could be more than that, but nonetheless, that's the sort of thing. Infrastructures are being targeted, so it's on, and so Russia's retaliated with some airstrikes, missile strikes against other infrastructure and decision-making targets, military targets, even in Kiev, but all around Ukraine. And obviously they're having kittens right now in the U.S. media. They can't believe that Russia has actually retaliated. And if you look at the way this is covered by the Western press, it's interesting. They have the usual blood on the shirt, the sort of, you know, bandana tied, bleeding, Ukrainian peasant, that sort of obligatory made-for-media shot. And I'm not saying that this is fake and crisis actors, but we have seen early on in this conflict some absolutely egregious propaganda that you could call fake news, which was splashed all over the Western mainstream media, like this of the same image of the same woman who is supposedly a victim of a Russian airstrike, and we find out that's not actually the case.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money
any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided, rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
Instead of putting a cracker under a politician, why not some TNT? Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, back here, and I'm back with Ulla Fritjofsson, and we are deep in the story of the Iran-Contra, what would you call that, conspiracy. It's a real conspiracy, it's not a theory, but sometimes it takes more than 40 years to find out the truth. And this is what we're talking about now. So if you listen to that, it's the past, but take it as the antidote to what you hear in the media, because at that time you didn't hear what was happening there, only bits of pieces by brave journalists like Gary Webb, who paid with his life for that. And if you listen to the news 24/7, you wouldn't have been able to understand what was going on there, because it's all backdoor shenanigans and deception operations and psyops and political warfare and covert warfare. So how does Iran-Contra connect to the Palmer murder?
I think you should also mention Robert Perry, at the Consortium News, founder of Consortium News. He did a lot of good journalism and revealed a lot of things within the Iran-Contra stories. Well, it connects because Jean Tatum and others say that in order to bypass the Boland Act, was an act in American Congress passed called Boland Act after his the politician that founded the Boland Act, and it forbade you were not allowed from, America was not allowed to send weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua, and in order to and to Iran, and in order to bypass all this, they used third party countries. And since Swedish weapons industry already had established a smuggle route, you could say, illegal, with Swedish weaponry to Iran, it was very convenient to use that system to get the American missiles, the Hawk missiles, to Iran. And to get that in place, it's said that Dick Allen and North had a meeting with Olof Palme late 1985. And of course, we don't know if this meeting really took place, but and I know that if it took place, it was not in Sweden, because I've checked that. It had to be somewhere else, but Palme was traveling a lot. And Palme was, all this was laid out in his knee. Could we get Swedish end user certificates for this weaponry, so that nobody would understand it really was American weaponry, and that we were doing this in violation of the Boland Act. And Olof Palme is said to have said, no, we will not participate in this. And it's also interesting to know that Palme was appointed negotiator, the United Nations appointed him negotiator with Iraq and at this time. And he was deeply involved in the Middle East stories at the time. And Jean Tatum then has said in public that Palme was killed weeks after this meeting. Of course, we don't know if this is what really happened. I think that this is not the truth, the whole truth. But if Olof Palme had agreed to using Swedish end user certificates for this American illegal trade of weapon, he would have been totally in the hands of the Americans. He could not any longer have any independent platform. He would have totally sold himself and his soul out to the Americans. So in a way, if he said yes, he would have been politically dead in international affairs. And perhaps that was the reason why they did this. I don't know. And then what really took place when Olof Palme was murdered, we don't know, but there was this milieu of hatred towards him and his persona and his politics. He was regarded as a traitor. So things got stirred up to the level where it was possible to get people to think of killing the Swedish prime minister in Sweden.
And they were talking about it. I think you have to mention that.
They were talking about it in meetings and so on. And Palme was warned, but really nothing really happened with people in right-wing circles that he was going to be killed some weeks before this happened in the 28th of February 1986. And then we go back to the stay behind system, because there was a MI6 agent, McFalkirk, working in Stockholm, but based in the Kolsås NATO base in Norway. And he managed to get the program for a planned visit. Olof Palme planned to visit Gorbachev in Soviet Union in April 1986. And the program for that was delivered to McFalkirk. A woman gave him this paper, and he photographed it in a store close to the government buildings in Stockholm. And the original was returned to Olof Palme's office, and the copy was then circulated to the station chief, a woman in CIA station in Stockholm. And she organized a meeting with high-level Swedish naval officers and agitated them to do something. And I think that high-level naval officers means that somebody among them had to be an admiral, which closes in.
I think we also have to explain, because this it's in the time frame of the Soviet alleged Soviet submarines going into Swedish waters. Yeah. So this meeting with Gorbachev would have meant first that they both were, Gorbachev really, let's say, he bought into the common security strategy. He came up with all these proposals for disarmament, and he was, he said that Russia will, Soviet Union will do to the Americans the worst thing possible. They will retreat to be an enemy. They will not be an enemy. So this is what he did. He came out with all these proposals. So there was on the horizon, while Palme was not being helpful in the selling of the Iran-Contra arms to Iran. At the same time, he was dealing in South Africa against the apartheid regime. And he was, in this connection, he was shortly to be, it was clear that when Palme and Gorbachev would speak, they would speak about the submarines. The whole thing could become public. It could become a public issue between the two countries. And there would be kind of a realignment. That what Palme wanted and what Gorbachev wanted. He was looking into Sweden as a social democratic model for the Soviet Union. He was contemplating to have some of the proposals from Palme to get realized in Soviet Union, which still was supposed to be a socialist country, but a democratic country with a market, with market reforms. So this is going on, and this is why this paper that you mentioned is important. It's not simply an itinerary. It is an itinerary that will again show Sweden alone on the run for real neutrality away from the United States strategy.
Mm. Right. And so it was in this milieu of Palme being a traitor, selling out Swedish interests to the Soviets, that the military people met with the CIA station and talked about what, I don't know. So that's from McFalkirk, and I can talk more about McFalkirk later. He died in the 1990s something. And he was living in Sweden. He had been in the resistance during the Second World War, in Danish and Norwegian resistance. He was a Brit, or like McFalkirk, I guess he was a non-Catholic Scottish or Irish. I don't know. Anyhow, from the British Islands. And then another source, Oswald Lewinter, who was proven to be number two in CIA Europe at the time, he provided information after the killing of Olof Palme. And we know this about Mac Falkirk because he has been talking about it to Swedish people about it after the killing. And the same did Lewinter, Oswald Lewinter. And there were some Swedish people testing him. And he could prove that he was employed by the CIA. He could prove that he had very close knowledge, good knowledge about Swedish military people, and especially about these stay behind people attending meetings we didn't know took place, where Swedish from the non-aligned Sweden, the Swedish stay behind people took part of some of the meetings held in NATO stay behind system. It was a meetings called Allied Clandestine Committee. And there they discussed in the fall of 1985, they discussed that the Olof Palme had to be dealt with by all means necessary, I think it was called, or all means possible. And if the Swedes didn't take care of this, somebody else would have taken care of it. So there are some protocols on this. And of course, you can question whether this is real or if it's disinformation, and we don't really know, but we know that the one that provided us with this information, he is a true CIA operative, second in command in Europe at the time, and with very good knowledge about Swedish circumstances. He was actually a poet. He wrote poetry, and he admired a Nobel Prize laureate winner in poets in literature, Thomas Tranströmer. He had some feelings for Sweden, and he was dissatisfied with the situation within the CIA. He wanted to be.
I once did an interview with Oswald Lewinter, and it's very strange. He wrote poetry in Portuguese. He was an American, and imagine he wrote, and that was when won prizes in Portugal. So it's a very, very strange, very capable person. Also, I have been offered this document, not by him. I got it via another source. I won't tell how and why. Mm. And I considered I was too careful with that. I thought it, I didn't consider it real, because it was like, it was a bombshell document, because it states that, as you said, there's the possibility of a neutral free zone, and they have to deal with Olof Palme. Basically, if the Swedes cannot do it, we do it. And then the Swedes said, we will do it. We will deal with that.
Yeah.
So that was like a very, very, very strange thing. But my colleague, Patrick Barb, is a German investigative journalist who worked on another murder case, also connected to Iran-Contra, the German minister of one of the German states, who was killed also, I think it was 87, if I remember correctly, the year. And Uwe Barschel. Uwe Barschel was killed in 87. My colleague is Patrick Barb. He got this document via a BND source. So there, I was very, very astonished. He said, I have it from a reliable source. And then I learned that it was from a BND person. And that is strange, because why should a BND? I mean, this is quite a story, as you have told it already. And why should a BND agent, which is close to the Americans, as close that you cannot put a piece of paper between them, I guess, why should he do that? So that is really...
I think that people within the system, they think that they overstepped when they killed Olof Palme, because it was in a Western democratic country, parliamentary system, nice and kind Swedes, and he was murdered brutally on the street, and together with his wife. She was not murdered, but she was injured. And so there are several sources, reliable, I think, sources. You know, Mike Falkirk was an MI6 agent. Oswald Levinte was a CIA operative. Actually also ended up in prison, as Gene Tatum did. That's a way of taking away, you know, credibility. Mm.
And if you look in Wikipedia, Oswald Levinte is a hoaxer, by the way.
Yeah, right. And we skip the content of this document from this Allied Clandestine Committee, but I consider it being plausible, and I think it's probable true what's in there, because even if there are some bombshell information in that document, because of the source, I don't see why Levinte should have contributed with this if he wanted to put blame somewhere else than the Americans, because he doesn't. I mean, it's evident that if the Swedes don't do this, well, then we will do it. And there's also other information that is circumstantial, but another journalist, Swedish, has information that on the night that Olof Palme was murdered, there was an ongoing exercise in this Stay Behind network, trying to prevent, rehearsing to prevent coup d'etat. I think that if this, and he says that this has very reliable sources for this, and that it will be really revealed in the years coming, because these people will talk, he says, I don't know. But I mean, if there was this kind of exercise in involving the Swedish Stay Behind, and they wanted to prevent the coup d'etat, Olof Palme could very well have said, "Okay, I want to do that because I feel really threatened. I don't like the climate I'm working in, and I really want this." So he could have participated, and then as happens, in other cases, exercise turned to reality. Some people took the opportunity to use this. This is one hypothesis, so to say. This is not anything that can be proven unless those sources come forward. But Mike Falkirk, he provided this program, and it was this important, as you said, that would have happened if the 11 time zone Soviet Empire would have survived in another form, inspired by social democratic thoughts, politics, and aiming to not confront the world, but to be part of this common security measures. Well, then shareholder value grabbing, like Bill Browder and others did, would not have taken place. I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union would not have been the same with Gorbachev and the Soviet Union intact. And so this was also a big threat to the American interests. And after the murder, Olof Mike Falkirk met with the head of the Swedish Psychological Defense, the chairman of the Swedish Psychological Defense, and the former defense minister and foreign minister Sven Andersson, who also happens to be my father's boss during 10 years at the Ministry of Defense, 58 to 67, Sven Andersson. He met with those two people, and that's 1 week after the murder at the China restaurant in a central place in Stockholm, and he told another journalist, Ola Alsén, what they said, and the chairman of the Swedish Psychological Defense at this meeting, according to Mike Falkirk, said that if the Swedes get to know why Olof Palme and how Olof Palme was murdered, this Sweden will not be the same in 100 years from now. And that also points to Swedish participation in the murder, because if some other nation's secret service or agents killed Olof Palme, then it would not have taken 100 years for the Swedes to get over that. It would have put a mark in the Swedish policy and the Swedish minds, but we would have come over it. But if Swedish people, if establishment people in Sweden were part of the murder, then really it will take 100 years. So it makes sense that the chairman of the psychological defense says such a thing. It's very interesting that he met those two very centrally placed persons, Sven O. Andersson and Sven Andersson, almost the same name, 1 week after the murder, and that they met the MI6 secret agent, McFalkirk. Mm. He was known to be a social democrat, by the way, because he had been living in Sweden for 30 years. He was a new acclimatized, so say, Swedish social democrat. And so I would say the role of these people, Sven Andersson, is said by very believable people, like having been in charge of the most sensitive defense matters long after he left his position as Minister of Defense. He left that position in 1973 to become the foreign minister until 1976. And in 1979, during a political government, when Undersecretary of State was going around learning about how the defense works, he was told by people that so this most sensitive questions, issues, is still on Sven Andersson's shoulders, so to say. He's still his responsibility. And two of the most sensitive things were the stay behind that was supposed to put up defense, guerrilla warfare and so on, if Sweden was occupied. But in the decades after the Second World War, more and more developed to be like an internal controlling factor for the Americans, controlling European politics, especially when left-wing or social democratic governments did things that they didn't like. And so the same that happened Aldo Moro happened to Olof Palme 10 years later, about 8 years later. And you also can go back to the murder attempts on Charles de Gaulle. He was, you know,
yeah, let's have a break here before we go to Charles de Gaulle. And I also have the question why the big murder investigation for 2 years or so in the Swedish in the Swedish police came up and as you said, an anticlimax. It was an implosion coming up with this thesis. None of these tracks, and there are other leads to South Africa and so on, had materialized into something that they would report to the public. Only you do that now. So after the advertisement, let's get to that question. What is the reason that we didn't hear about all these things in the murder investigation?
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse is expected to give up his Senate seat in December to take on the position of president at the University of Florida. Before serving in the Senate, Sasse was president of Midland University and taught at the University of Texas at Austin. And keep in mind that he voted to impeach President Donald Trump during trial number two. But none of that was enough to overcome the pure hatred and vitriol that greeted the senator as he appeared on the Florida campus this past Monday. Fox reports that student organizations gathered outside the building to protest the nomination, including the Young Democratic Socialists of America, UF Communists, and UF College Democrats. He was blasted as anti-gay marriage, anti-trans, anti-abortion, and he was called a homophobic piece of S by one of those punks who said they wanted to make his life miserable. As he was entering a police van that would take him off campus, a single protester could be heard saying, "We don't want you here." Now, the school's board of trustees still has to vote on the appointment on November 1st. Want to bet the vote might be no? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
The electric vehicle, saving the planet, killing children. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we are back with Ola Frithiofsson and the Doug Pullman Show. And we have 12 minutes left, Ola, so we have to be very concise now. The question is, why was none of what you just told us? And that's not even the full story. For example, what we left out is that the deputy Swedish intelligence chief from the SÄPO, from the Interior Intelligence, was told by James Jesus Angleton, the foreign, the CIA counter-espionage chief, that Olof Palme was a KGB agent. He said that in an interview. So it's up to that point where they would get hints that something had to be done. And these were parts of the discussions that people in the Swedish security circles were discussing, that he had to be stopped one way or another, politically or physically. And so why did the police, after these long investigations and your article with 100 footnotes, why did they come up with a story that it was a lone gunman, the Skandia man? And by the way, the Skandia building was the center for the Stay Behind network, isn't it? So give us a short wrap up.
To explain that, I think I should also say that CIA's second man in Europe, Oswald Lewinter, he did not only give information about this Allied clandestine committee meeting where they discussed the murder of Olof Palme in Stay Behind circles, but he also revealed that there was a meeting at the owner to Bofors weapons industry that was smuggling weapons to Iran, Erik Penser. There was a meeting in the fall of 1985 with the top brass of the Swedish business executives and owners, capital owners, like 6-7 people named, but I perhaps shouldn't name them now, but named in that document that Lewinter provided, and that they were also discussing the murder of Olof Palme. And when the establishment seems to be involved in this way, you have the security police, they thought after information from Angleton, then he was sacked, Angleton, by the director of CIA, wasn't it, Colby? Because he was thought to be paranoid.
But I think
Jesse Helms, you're right. But the Swedish intelligence, they thought they could rely on this paranoid, sacked, counter-espionage guy. It shows the Swedish political naivety in those circles, I think. And and then if the establishment and the security establishment was involved in this way, of course, it's and the head of the psychological defense, Sweden would not be the same in 100 years. It could not, the truth cannot come out. You have to find some other probable suspect. And I don't know if they realized that this police and prosecutor team that I was able to talk to, and that took a lot of time, they must have, to check out all the what I sent them. And that told me when I met them that, okay, Olof Palme did really stop weapons smuggling from Bofors to Iran in the fall of 1985. He did stop that. And that has not been, you know, the official truth either, but they told me that. And this was the belief in these among those investigating the murder. Why then would they end up with this lone nut murderer only for the reason that they are not allowed to tell the truth? That is what I believe. And it would hurt Sweden too much. It would mean that we would not be the same in 100 years. But I would also add that not being able to get the truth does not mean that the Swedish country, the Swedish people, will be the same as before. Because this sows distrust, this sows suspicion and disbelief in what the official sources says. I guess what I'm telling you now also do that, but it's because of this that we don't get the truth, that people keep trying to get the truth. And I believe that the secret is so big, So it's not allowed to get out. And I have, you know, they say that this Stig Engström, the Skandiamannen, killed Olof Palme. And it's they reason like, you know, they go around in their own circles. They say, oh, he killed Olof Palme. And then you say, but how could he do that? Then he must have had a revolver. Yes, if he killed Olof Palme, he must have had a revolver with him to work. And then the by chance saw Olof Palme wanted to kill him. So he took his revolver that he by chance had taken to the office where he worked as a, you know, he worked with advertising, marketing, and handworks on that, and killed him. So there's not, I would say, not many people in Sweden that really believe this story. And when they told this at the press conference in June 2020, not only I thought it was an anticlimax, but I think very, very many Swedes.
And, not only Swedes. Me as a German, I watched the conference and listened to it on English translation, and I was completely underwhelmed. I think it was the most underwhelming press conference I ever encountered. Mm. Yeah.
Well.
And what does it tell us about the upcoming investigation? We also, there's this very strange case of the Estonia, which I wanted to get into. Maybe we have to do another round of another interview. But what it tells me, upcoming is now the Swedish investigation on the pipeline explosion. And shortly after, Sweden became a member of NATO. So from this experience, from the Palme murder, I think we can say... how trustworthy any outcome of any investigation from the Swedish side is after this experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it Der Spiegel, Jutta Rabe, the German journalist worked at, and she found out some things about Estonia. And
yes,
also now there's a group working with Estonia offside, so to say, aside of the official investigation. And they have, discovered that there was an explosion on board Estonia afterwards or before, we don't know. But the bow visor, the thing that, you know, opens up when you drive into the ferry or out of the ferry, that had been blown out. And there was a metallurgic professor at the University of Trondheim that very, very scientifically proved that this must have been the case, because the metal couldn't have formed on molecular level the way it formed if there was not a very, very rapid increase of heat that molded the metal together in that way. So I don't know, it really bothers me a lot, the current situation. And of course, the Swedish application to NATO, I think, in the worst of times.
Yeah, I think we'll have to discuss that. I didn't want to jump into that right
but
now.
But if you go back to we'll go back to this description. My thesis and what I write about is that over decades you have the same use of false flags, psychological operations to bend people's minds to be in line with American interests. They tried it on American soil in the Cuban conflict. John F. Kennedy stopped that. They tried it and executed it in Italy, a strategy of tension in the 1970s. They tried it and executed it in Swedish waters and with Olof Palme in the 1980s. And we could leave out Charles de Gaulle because that's another story, but he had the same profile as Aldo Moro. He wanted, you know, Europe between Portugal and Ural Mountains, including Russia. And he wanted to have independence within NATO. And he wanted to have the nuclear weapons in France only under France command and so on. He was thought selling out oil interests to Soviet in Algeria, Northern Africa, when France left the colonization of Algeria, and he was supposed to be dead together with his wife, the dozen sharpshooters from OIS, the French secret service,
No, not the Secret Service. Organization on to create a terrorist organization. Yeah.
Yeah, right. A terrorist organization. Mm. Right. Sorry. And, but I've been talking about history a lot, and we can stop by the 70s and the 60s in the United States.
Yeah, we are stopped by the clock now. We cannot go on this way. It's what you mentioned is that it boils down to the fact that Charles de Gaulle, who had several murder attempts on him, personally wrote, and also a close advisor to him wrote in the memoirs, that the same people who killed JFK, that's a quote from Charles de Gaulle, were also trying to kill him. And that might be another story. I think we have to go back and discuss things a little bit more, Ola. There's much more to talk about. And thank you for this session, and thank you to the listeners, and hope to see you and hear from you again, Ola Fridtjofsson from Sweden.